heat risk. And we were able to put them all on this interactive map where you can search most facilities or search individual communities and come up with, kind of mini profiles of the facilities with the risk levels that they appear to be facing.
We have to leave it there, but we're going to link to that climate and punishment data map at democracynow.org. Aline Brown, we thank you so much for being with us of The Intercept, a part of this investigative project. Absolutely remarkable. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman. Stay safe. Wear a mask. Wearing a mask is an act of love.
Tuned in to listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
Prison Pipeline is a radio program dedicated to educating the public about the Oregon criminal justice system. Topics include incarceration and reentry, addictions and mental health, elections and laws, victims' rights, and criminal justice reform. The program presents a unique understanding of the criminal justice system, addresses the root causes of crime, and challenges the status quo. It seeks to promote awareness and activism in order to foster a safer, healthier, and more just society.
Prison Pipeline airs on Monday evenings from 6:30 to 7 p.m. on KBOO Portland. Check us out every week. If you miss an episode, you can stream it later. Just go to kboo.fm/prisonpipeline. More info about upcoming shows and events related to the prison community can be found on our Facebook page, Prison Pipeline. Be sure to like us.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, a shocking city memo proposes extreme measures to tackle the houselessness crisis. A wave energy center in Newport is to be America's first. And in international news, Russia asks for diplomatic response on Ukraine. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, February 14th, 2022. I'm Althea Billings. The state of Oregon turns 163 today. On February 14th, 1859, the U.S. Congress ratified Oregon statehood, despite the former territory lacking the requisite population for representation. Oregon statehood became a nationally contentious issue, with abolitionists and slaveholders alike objecting to the new whites-only state. Although Oregon had voted against slavery, some Republicans objected to its constitutional ban on black settlement and discrimination towards Chinese immigrants. In the following decades, Oregon's economy grew rapidly as canneries and lumber mills opened along the Willamette Valley. By the turn of the century, Portland had transformed into a major port and one of the most dangerous cities in the country. A lot has changed since then. Oregon's forests have stronger legal protections, and salmon runs have decreased to the point where canning is no longer commercially viable. Farming and manufacturing replaced primary resource extraction as the state's principal activities, and the state has become one of America's most progressive. Nonetheless, Oregon continues to grapple with its legacy of white supremacy, and new threats such as climate change and unsustainable logging imperil its famous natural beauty. A leaked memo from Sam Adams, Portland's director of strategic innovations, proposes phasing in a complete ban on public camping and enlisting the National Guard to set up outdoor encampments. With more on the story, here's KBOO's Ethan Sandweiss.
The Portland mayor's office may plan to force houseless residents into mass shelters, according to an internal memo obtained by local media. The memo is from Portland's director of strategic innovations, Sam Adams, outlining controversial plans for Portland's homeless population. The January 31st memo proposed to end unsanctioned camping and clean up the city starting June of this year. Sam Adams was the mayor of Portland from 2009 to 2012. He suggested enlisting unarmed National Guard security specialists to manage three mass camping sites capable of housing up to 3,000 people at a time. The memo detailed a phased approach that would force homeless people out of camps on sidewalks, near schools and hospitals, and on busy roads. Some of these locations are already considered illegal by the city. Last week, Mayor Ted Wheeler banned camping on busy roads following a slew of fatal accidents involving houseless campers. Advocacy groups, including Central City Concern and Streetwalks, have publicly condemned the order, citing other factors in rising death rates. Adams' memo urges the governor and mayor to issue a joint emergency declaration on homelessness for federal funding and FEMA support. The National Guard is usually deployed in the wake of natural disasters, although states have increasingly deployed them for political purposes. Notably, former President Donald Trump asked states to deploy their National Guard on the southern border. Nearly half of troops deployed to Iraq and Afghanistan in the past 20 years are from the National Guard and reserves. Housing advocates have balked at the memo, and several city commissioners, including Joanne Hardesty and Carmen Rubio, have described the plan as a non-starter. Still, pressure continues to grow for a quick resolution. A poll last year by the hardline anti-camping lobby Portland Business Alliance showed almost 80% of Portlanders surveyed wanted to require the homeless to camp in designated areas or shelters. Public angst may hamper the city's current plan to construct six safe rest villages. Commissioner Dan Ryan's plan to open six controlled camping sites unanimously passed a city council vote last June. So far, only three of those sites have been identified and no construction progress has been made. In many ways, Adams' proposed camping sites look similar to the popular Safe Rest Village plan. They will be staffed with medical and social work personnel on city-owned land or private land seized with eminent domain. What changes is the aggressive response to unsanctioned camping, which has been somewhat mitigated by a federal lawsuit against the city. Sam Adams spoke out about his memo, acknowledging that his ideas could be startling. He also reiterated that there is no current plan to implement his suggestions. The full text of Sam Adams' memo can be found online at streetroots.org. Reporting for KBOO News, I'm Ethan Sandweiss.
Around 15,000 Portland homes have lead solder in their pipes, leading to an increased risk of lead poisoning. Houses built between 1970 and 1985 are at particularly high risk. The city's municipal pipes don't contain lead, which may be part of the reason that household lead levels have evaded detection for so long. As old pipes begin to corrode after 40 years, it raises the risk of household lead seeping into the city's water supply. Luckily, the Water Bureau began constructing a federally mandated water treatment facility in 2017 to reduce the corrosiveness of city water, a measure which reduces the amount of lead it absorbs. The new plant is expected to open this spring. Multnomah County is offering free water testing kits on their website for people who believe their homes may be at risk, and the lead line can be contacted at 503-988-4000. Portlanders mark this Valentine's Day by remembering loved ones who have died in the past 2 years and healthcare workers who saved the lives of others. With more on the story, it's Eric Tegedoff.
To mark the losses of the past 2 years from the COVID-19 pandemic, people are posting Valentine's Day cards in Portland. A wall in the city has been dedicated to Valentine's to loved ones people have lost, and thanks to folks on the front lines, such as first responders and teachers. Betsy Zucker is a retired nurse practitioner and chair of the Healthcare Committee for Portland Jobs with Justice. She says in order to act on the pandemic, we have to recognize how much it has affected our lives.
This action around Valentine's Day when we think tenderly about people we love and things that we love to do together is just a time to bring that forward and let people resonate with it.
In Oregon, there have been more than 6,300 deaths from COVID-19 and 672,000 cases. The action is part of a larger movement called End the Pandemic Now, which is urging the U.S. government to do more to increase access to the vaccines globally. Hillary Hayden with the Trade Justice Education Fund says billions of people around the world don't have access to vaccines, which is not only leading to more deaths, but also allowing new variants to take hold. She says one way to ensure more people can get access is to temporarily waive intellectual property rules around vaccines with the World Trade Organization, which the Biden administration came out in favor of last year.
But they're not doing a lot to move that waiver forward. And so part of our actions in these Valentine's Day spaces and also the other actions that our organization works on are really pressing the Biden administration to do more at the WTO to really push this forward.
Hayden says Congress also can take action by passing the End the Pandemic Now plan. The resolution calls for temporarily waiving intellectual property rules for vaccines, sharing technology, and funding other countries' efforts to ramp up production. For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
The Oregon Department of Justice said no to plans for building an entertainment and gambling venue in Grants Pass. The Oregon Gambling Commission had asked whether it was legal to operate a facility with 225 horse racing terminals, which are similar to slot machines, and allow participants to bet on some horse races. The Department of Justice opinion suggested offering those gaming machines constitutes a casino. It specifically stated such machines, quote, are a game of chance that do not afford players any meaningful opportunity to exercise skill, end quote. Oregon doesn't allow casinos or lotteries unless they're located on tribal land or run by the state. Multiple millions of dollars had been put towards building horse racing terminals, specifically in a facility known as the Flying Lark. Racing terminals were said to be necessary to make the overall project financially viable, and without them, the venue allegedly cannot open. Several Oregon tribes voiced opposition to the project, saying it would interfere with casinos they operate. Flying Lark representatives stated the venue would bring hundreds of jobs into Josephine County and that there may now be permanent mass layoffs because of the Department of Justice decision. Oregon voters upheld the ban on private casinos in 2010. 7 miles offshore Newport, Oregon, will soon be home to the first grid-connected wave energy test site in the United States. The U.S. Department of Energy awarded a $25 million grant to PacWave, an experimental facility run in collaboration with faculty at Oregon State. Tidal energy has long been theoretical. The sea is a corrosive and turbulent environment, which has made engineering lasting wave energy plants difficult. However, researchers at PacWave predict that if implemented, tidal energy could meet up to 10% of America's energy needs. Wave power is generated around the clock, unlike solar and wind power. Wave power plants are also generally invisible from the land and occupy less space. Like other renewable energy sources, it has a zero carbon footprint. The conditions off the Oregon coast make it an ideal environment as a pilot test site, the first in the U.S. President Biden prepares to respond to Putin on Ukraine. With that and other stories, it's Nadia Ramlagan with 2022 Talks.
Welcome to 2022 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
So far, we've only seen escalation from Moscow. This is a pivotal moment. We're prepared for whatever should happen.
Secretary of State Antony Blinken was in Fiji over the weekend, but he described as troubling new Russian deployments near the border of Ukraine. President Joe Biden and Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky spoke by phone for an hour Sunday. And Vice President Kamala Harris heads to Germany this week for a security conference. The Munich visit marks her fifth foreign trip as a vice president. Before her trip, Harris stopped in New Jersey Friday. She spoke about Newark's efforts to replace its lead water pipes.
It is a public health issue. It is an equity issue. It is an issue of education. It is an issue of whether we are willing to invest in our future in terms of investing in our communities.
Some civil rights leaders are pushing for faster administration action to replace lead pipes that hurt Black and Latino communities. A Canadian judge has granted police more authority to remove vaccine mandate protesters blocking the Ambassador Bridge to Detroit. Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau on the five-day blockade by truckers at the border.
The blockades are hurting small businesses and neighborhoods. At the border, they're impacting trade, supply chains, and manufacturing. The people these blockades are hurting are everyday families.
According to the New York Times, Rudy Giuliani is in active discussions with the House committee investigating the January 6th insurrection. The former New York mayor and lawyer for former President Donald Trump is under subpoena to testify about how closely Trump coordinated with the mob that attempted to overturn the election. A jury of nine is expected to resume deliberations today in former Republican vice presidential candidate Sarah Palin's libel case against the Times. Palin sued the newspaper over an editorial linking her to a deadly 2011 shooting in Tucson that killed six and wounded then-member of Congress Gabby Giffords. Syracuse University law professor Roy Gutterman.
And Governor Palin is arguing that her reputation has been damaged by this false mistake that was published and corrected. The Times went really quickly and within 14 hours published a correction to set the record straight.
James Bennett, then the editorial page editor at the Times, has denied the newspaper intentionally tried to defame Palin. The Times corrected the article and says the error didn't harm Palin's reputation. I'm Nadia Ramlagan for Pacifica Network and Public News Service.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Making Contact. At 6, it's Labor Radio, then at 6:30, it's Prison Pipeline. After this weekend's record high temperatures, things will cool off tonight into the low 40s. Tomorrow will be cool and overcast with a slight chance of rain. Today in history, 32 years ago, the Voyager 1 space probe took a picture of Earth from a distance of 6 billion kilometers. The famous pale blue dot photo shows Earth as a white speck against the backdrop of the cosmos. The quote of the day is from astronomer Carl Sagan, who said, quote, "It has been said that astronomy is a humbling and character-building experience. There is perhaps no better demonstration of the folly of human conceits than this distant image of our tiny world. To me, it underscores our responsibility to deal more kindly with one another and to preserve and cherish the pale blue dot, the only home we've ever known." The opioid epidemic raged alongside COVID, and the number of overdoses went up 30% in 2020. Some communities have seen a sharp drop in opioid deaths after introducing harm reduction services like needle exchanges and improved access to Narcan. With more, here's Mary Sherman.
As the nation shifts towards ending the pandemic phase of COVID-19, another health crisis appears to be worsening. A new bipartisan congressional report says drug overdose deaths surpassed 100,000 nationally in 1 year, and most involve synthetic opioids like fentanyl. Here in Ohio, fentanyl killed nearly 19,000 people between 2016 and 2021, the highest number among states. Linda Sider runs Caracol, a Hamilton County organization that provides what are known as harm reduction supplies to drug users. She says fentanyl can be found in almost every illicit drug now.
Not just heroin, even meth and crack, and oftentimes people are unprepared for the fentanyl that whatever they're smoking may be laced with. They are at risk for an overdose.
Unlike most other areas, Hamilton County has seen a 34% decrease in opioid-related deaths in the last several months. Sider says the decline is attributed to harm reduction measures, including expanded availability of the anti-overdose medication naloxone, needle exchanges, and public education about overdose prevention. Caracol is home to the first harm reduction vending machine in the Midwest. Sider explains it provides free access 24/7 to supplies that can help prevent disease and overdose.
The machine dispenses safe injection kits without syringes. The kits include cookers and tourniquets and Narcan and fentanyl test strips, and then information about treatment resources as well.
Sider says abstinence-only education isn't always successful, so harm reduction focuses on building a respectful relationship with a stigmatized group.
People who use drugs, they come in the door expecting to be judged. That's their experience. And if you tell people you need to get sober, they may or may not, and many will not. And so how do we keep them as safe as they can be in the meantime?
The congressional report calls for a strategy that focuses on shutting down sources of chemicals used to make synthetic opioids. It also recommends fostering development of opioid alternatives, investing in addiction research, and getting treatment and support to people who become addicted. For Ohio News Connection, I'm Mary Sherman.
Boston's city council has proposed the creation of a new reparations committee to address the legacy of slavery and institutional hurdles facing Black Bostonians. With more, here's Lily Bolke.
A proposal brought to the Boston City Council would create a commission to study the legacy of slavery and the ongoing inequities Black people face in Massachusetts, and to put together proposals for reparations. Boston could be the latest of a growing number of cities exploring ways to repair the harms racism has caused in their communities. Tammy Tai, with the nonprofit King Boston, notes Amherst and Cambridge are the first two in Massachusetts, and she hopes Boston will follow. She says reparations can take many forms, from payments to individuals to holistic education in schools or home ownership programs.
It first begins with the acknowledgement of what has occurred for the Black community in Boston, which of course is reflective and a microcosm of what Black folks in America have experienced.
She notes Evanston, Illinois, was the first city to adopt a system of reparations in the form of housing grants of up to $25,000. Tai says housing may not be the right approach for Boston, but if the proposal passes, the commission will examine the options. Tai adds there has sometimes been a misconception that because Boston is a northern city, reparations aren't needed, but she points out that Massachusetts was initially one of the principal slave trading colonies, and today white residents of Boston are more likely to own homes and have checking or savings accounts and retirement funds than Black, brown, and indigenous residents.
So even though slavery was abolished earlier than the Emancipation Proclamation, slavery still touched the lives here in the city, and then Jim Crow touched the lives of Black folks in the city and the ongoing inequity. So for a northern city to be reckoning with this and wrestling with this is hugely important for the country.
In the U.S. House, a bill for nationwide reparations, H.R. 40, was first introduced more than 30 years ago, but hasn't made it through the chamber. Tai says while reparations at the local level are important, state and federal action is also needed. This is Lily Bolke with Commonwealth News Service.
United States Olympian Erin Jackson took home gold at the Beijing Olympics in speed skating. She's the first Black woman to win an Olympic medal in the sport. The former inline skater and roller derby enthusiast initially didn't qualify for the event after slipping during the U.S. trials. Her friend and teammate Brittany Bowe gave up her own spot so Jackson could attend the Olympics. Erin Jackson is also the first American woman to win an Olympic speed skating event since 2002 and the first to win the 500 meters since 1994. A man has been convicted in Fairbanks, Alaska for the 1993 murder and rape of a 20-year-old Native Alaskan woman. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A Fairbanks, Alaska jury returned guilty verdicts Thursday for a man who killed a young Alaska Native woman in 1993 at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. Stephen Downs was convicted in the rape and murder of 20-year-old Sophie Sergey. KUAC's Robin reports.
Sophie Sergey had been a marine biology student at the university the year before. She returned to Fairbanks from her tiny Yupik village of Pitkus Point in far western Alaska the last weekend of April 1993 for an orthodontist appointment on the following Monday. She stayed in the dorm with a friend who knew her from their time together in Native youth leadership organizations. She was last seen after midnight Sunday, on her way to have a cigarette. She was found Monday afternoon in a restroom down the hall. She had been raped and shot in the head. The defendant, Stephen Downs of Maine, was never suspected of the crime until 25 years later, when DNA collected from the crime scene was partially matched to a profile in a commercial genealogy database in 2018. That profile was Downs's aunt. Alaska State Troopers traced the genealogy to Downs, who was living in the dorm that spring of 1993. Fairbanks Superior Court Judge Thomas Temple read the verdicts.
Murder in the first degree of SS. We, the jury, find the defendant guilty of murder in the first degree of SS, dated at Fairbanks, Alaska, the 10th day of February, 2022. Sexual assault in the first degree of SS. We, the jury, find the defendant guilty of sexual assault in the first degree of SS, dated at Fairbanks, Alaska, this 9th day of February, 2022, signed by the jury foreperson.
The victim's two brothers listened into the verdicts remotely from St. Mary's in the Yukon River Delta. Older brother Alexei Sergey said in an interview that he feels relieved after decades of uncertainty.
With the DNA, I'm pretty sure it's right, guy. Nowadays, DNA won't lie to you.
Alexei Sergey said he forgave the perpetrator decades ago in an effort towards closure.
I forgave him for what he did to me, but I'll never forget.
The judge scheduled sentencing in September. In Fairbanks, I'm Robin.
Sports wagering for Sunday's Super Bowl will be in full swing this year. Research from the American Gambling Association finds more than 18 million people plan to bet online, in person at sports books, or with a bookie on the matchup between the Los Angeles Rams and the Cincinnati Bengals. The Navajo Nation will soon get into the sports betting action. The tribe is teaming up with the Seminole Tribe of Florida's Hard Rock. They've joined forces to launch the Hard Rock Sportsbook mobile app in Arizona. John Chapper is Senior Director of Communications for Hard Rock Digital.
The Hard Rock Sportsbook app allows you to place bets on all the major sports. We'll have great promotions, also live betting. So if you see your team's losing, you think you got a big comeback in store, you can jump in there. Major sports, also some more niche sports. Soccer, you can do table tennis. It really just makes your game days a little more fun, a little more engaging, and allows you really to connect with the product on the screen.
Brian Parrish is the interim chief executive officer for the Navajo Nation Gaming Enterprise.
Really excited about our partnership with Hard Rock, with their sportsbook and Hard Rock Digital. They have an excellent team and outstanding product. Their value systems and their goals and objectives align very nicely with ours, and so it was a perfect fit.
Sports betting became legal in Arizona in 2021. The digital Hard Rock Sportsbook is expected to be launched in the state this month. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
The Canadian trucker protest that has blocked the border over vaccine mandates will likely be coming to an end after new actions from the Prime Minister. For the first time in history, Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau has invoked the Emergencies Act to respond to the anti-vaccine protests in Ottawa. The never-before-used Emergencies Act defines an emergency as a temporary, urgent, and critical situation that seriously endangers the lives, health, or safety of Canadians. By declaring an emergency, Trudeau effectively declares that the right-wing anti-vaccine protests constitute a threat to the security and sovereignty of the nation. The Ottawa protests are in their third week, and they've taken their toll as well as gotten international attention. The measure grants emergency powers to the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, who cleared anti-vaccine truckers off an Alberta border crossing Sunday. The Mounted Police found a cache of weapons and arrested 11 protesters. According to Deputy Prime Minister Chrystia Freeland, it also allows the Prime Minister's cabinet to freeze the assets of anyone linked to the protests without a court order. Authorities are particularly concerned about the financial networks fueling the violent protests. A hacked crowdfund for the protesters revealed that more than half the donations come from outside the country. Among them was $90,000 from Thomas C. Bell, the billionaire CEO of the artificial intelligence company C3 AI. To some extent, the anti-vaccine mandate protests have become a catch-all for far-right causes. In the early days of the protests, swastikas and Confederate flags could be seen hanging from trucks. Protesters were also harassing locals. The protests have shaken Canada, leading to a revolt within the Conservative Party, which ousted its leader for his sympathetic opinion on the protests. Over 90% of Canadian truckers are vaccinated, along with 80% of Canadians as a whole, one of the highest vaccine rates in the world. A recent poll showed over 60% of Canadians oppose the so-called Freedom Convoy. Tensions continue to mount on Ukraine's borders, but the Kremlin contends that diplomacy is still an option. With more, it's KBOO's Ethan Sandweiss.
Russia has deployed a sufficient number of troops on Ukraine's borders to launch a full invasion. Security experts say that in the event Putin decides to invade, Russian forces would most likely beeline for Kyiv, Ukraine's capital, and install a Moscow-friendly government rather than engage Ukraine's army on all fronts. The Kremlin maintains that it still hopes for a diplomatic solution. So far, NATO and Russia have failed to reach consensus on Russia's key demand that Ukraine never be allowed membership in the military alliance. Putin fears that if Western-friendly Ukraine joined NATO, it could put hostile forces and ballistic missiles on Russia's borders. Although there has been no indication that NATO would risk that sort of provocation, the U.S. sees Russia's demands as unreasonable and worries that Russia might invade its former territory to ensure compliance. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov commented today that Washington had proposed some de-escalation measures, including limits on missile deployments and military drills in the region. But that may not be enough. Other NATO leaders, such as France's Macron and Hungary's Orbán, have met with the Kremlin independently. Meanwhile, Ukraine's government has attempted to quell fears of an invasion. Security and Defense Council Chief Oleksiy Danilov said, "The situation is absolutely under control." Still, residents of Kyiv received communications from the mayor's office urging them to defend their city and marking the locations of impromptu bomb shelters. From KBOO News, I'm Ethan Sandweiss.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Monday, February 14th, 2022. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Josh Salem, the producer is Ethan Sandweiss, and the engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Nadia Ramlagan, Antonia Gonzalez, Eric Tegadoff, Lily Bolke, and Mary Sherman. The Directory of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM.